Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guests are palliative care physician B.J. Miller and IDEO editorial director and former editor-in-chief and co-founder of Ready Made magazine, Shoshana Berger. Their new book is A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. Joining them is Dr. Lucy Kalanathi, Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine and the widow of the late Dr. Paul Kalanathi, author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, When Breath Becomes Air, to which she wrote the epilogue. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces B.J. Miller, Shoshana Berger, and Lucy Kalanathi.
Tonight's conversation is part of Reimagine End of Life Festival. This is a community-driven initiative sparked by Reimagine, a new nonprofit organization that believes by facing death, we begin to live more fully. Dr. B.J. Miller is a hospice and palliative medicine physician who's worked in many settings, inpatient, outpatient, hospice facility, and home, and now sees patients and families at the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. Miller speaks all over the country and beyond on the theme of living well in the face of death. Shoshana Berger is the global editorial director at IDEO, where she has worked on projects ranging from the end of life to modern Judaism to school lunch. She was a senior editor at Wired and has written for the New York Times, Wired, Popular Science, Marie Claire, and Salon. She co-founded the DIY design magazine, Ready Made, later turning it into a book, Ready Made, How to Make Almost Everything a Do-It-Yourself Primer. Along with B.J. Miller, she's the author of A Beginner's Guide to the End. Dr. Lucy Kalanathi is a clinical assistant professor at Stanford. She helped complete the best-selling memoir, When Breath Becomes Air, which her late husband, Paul Kalanathi, a Stanford neurosurgeon, wrote before he died of lung cancer at the age of 37. Lucy does a lot of public speaking since then in healthcare and public venues, including TEDMED, the Aspen Institute Festival, and she currently is developing a podcast around the topic of hardship. Let's give them all a very warm welcome to the JCCSF. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. It's such a treat to be on stage tonight with you two. I'm totally thrilled. I love your beautiful, wise, funny book. I wanted to start with sort of a general question. So Abraham Verghese, the physician writer who wrote Cutting for Stone, who many of you maybe also love, said something so nice about this book. He said, I'll just read it straight from the cover, "This is a book that every family should have, the equivalent of Dr. Spock, but for this other phase of life." And I love that, and I'm wondering if maybe together, maybe starting with you, Shoshana, why don't you tell me what the book is and who it's for? And then I want to know what made you come together to write it.
Okay. So the book is kind of for everyone. I mean, we're all going to the same place. And I think part of the inception of the book was feeling like there's no operating instructions. There's no manual for this phase of life. And we always used the correlative of what to expect when you're expecting.
Like, oh, you did?
Yeah,
you were
like
writing.
There's this great, I mean, okay, it's not that great. It's kind of fear-mongering and awful. And, you know, it's like, if you don't eat the right food, your baby will die.
That's intense.
But we always did think, like, there's so much instruction and care and foresight and thought put into bringing new life into the world.
Right, and people were hungry for that book at the time.
I mean, it is like the, you know, after like TV Guide, the best-selling thing of all time. I think 90% of pregnant women read that book.
Wow.
Which is incredible. And we always say about our book that it has 100% market penetration. So I think, you know, we started out thinking there needs to be instructions for this other half of life. Does that ring true to you?
Yeah, it sounds about right. Yeah, and I guess from my point of view, and when Shoshana and I asked if we wanted to write this book together, I mean, it's a pretty quick yes for a lot of reasons that Shoshana's already said, but the basic gist, and you probably know this clinically, well, you definitely know this, Lucy, clinically, where you just see situations that don't have to be so hard, you know, over and over again, for systems issues or a lack of languaging or a concern for shame or whatever else makes hard situations even harder. And that's written all over the place with chronic illness and terminal illness. And so I think that was the impulse, was to sort of see if we could have a level setting, raise the floor a little bit so we all had a sort of a basic gist of what to think through so that it didn't have to be quite so hard.
That's so nice. I just want to tell you in the audience the kinds of things that are in this book. So there are things like the nuts and bolts of illness or dying, like having a folder in your house called When I Die. They literally wrote about that. How to talk about dying, how to cope, including some really beautiful writing and reflections and philosophy, and suggestions about everything from mindfulness to psychedelics, finances, hospital hacks, love and sex and relationships, regret, the question of can I choose to die, and a lot more than that. And the tone is really, it arrives at the right time. So tell us just quickly how you came to know each other. And like, it sounded like you solicited BJ.
That sounds very dirty.
Shoshana's husband's here today.
Yes, my husband's here, so.
Sorry, Tony.
So, yes, that is true. So what happened was, my father had just died, and I had just started working at this dreamy place called IDEO here in San Francisco, which is a design and innovation firm. And BJ and I were assigned to this project to kind of rebrand hospice, if you will. Like, hospice has such a bad rap and so much baggage. Yeah. And, you know, BJ has said that people often think that it is a place that kills you, or that you go to hospice to die and it's a death sentence. And, you know, BJ at the time was the executive director of the Zen Hospice, beautiful center here in San Francisco. And he wanted to just amplify that message that not only does it not kill you, but in fact, it is the greatest suite of care that you can get at the end of life. And it's free. It's a Medicare benefit. I mean, incredible. Mm-hmm. So let me just set the scene here. So IDEO, as is its wont to do, built a like igloo inside of our offices to have this conversation, this kickoff conversation about the end of life. And my colleagues were teasing us that we had created a death yurt inside the office. And BJ came to the office, and we walked through this tunnel, and there was like flickering light above, and then there was a candlelit stage, and about 10 of us sat in this death yurt and had a conversation about the end of life. And everyone was asked how they would like the end of their life to look. And there were some great reveries about this. You know, like, I want to be on an iceberg alone in Iceland. And, you know, you can almost hear the soundtrack starting. And you know, people had playlists, and they had, you know, they had some really interesting, very highly designed ways of dying. And I'm sitting there thinking, wow, this is not at all what death looked like.
And you were freshly grieving your dad at the time.
Yeah, I mean, this is not what it looked like when I was sitting in my sister's old bedroom with my father, who had been, you know, really out of it for quite a long time. It's just, you know, it's quiet. And it's not always pretty, and it's hard. And so BJ came in with this very beautiful and bold vision for how to kind of grapple with that experience in a different way, how to come to it and approach it and put your arms around it in a different way. And that just really lit me up when I was in the midst of grief. And also just a lot of confusion. Like, literally, my sister and I, when my dad died, sat down at the computer in his room and Googled, what do you do when someone dies? I mean, we were totally clueless.
Totally.
So when I met BJ and we embarked on this project, it became very clear to me that a lot of people probably need help with this.
Do you remember what you said in the igloo? Like that Shoshana responded to? Or like when you're hearing, you know Shoshana's there, and then you hear this person with the iceberg idea. Mm. Like, do you remember what you were bringing in the igloo?
I don't remember what I was saying. I remember what I was thinking. Because it was amazing. I mean, I loved going to the IDEO office. It's just such a creative, juicy place. You know, you feel your neurons firing just being in the building, and especially in this created sub-environment. It was a really remarkable feeling. And I was so thrilled to be outside of a clinical setting, to be having this conversation. Because there's a sort of an inherited thing, especially in palliative care, that everyone in the world's in denial, and no one wants to talk about this stuff, and so therefore don't talk about this stuff. I mean, there are a lot of assumptions made, and I think we keep learning the fact that denial, I think, is a little overplayed, that there is a zeal to talk about this. There's an interest, if we could just sort of set the space and lend some safety to it. But I remember what I was thinking. So we're hearing all these stories that were fantastic, because what I loved was hearing people thinking creatively about their death, about something that otherwise is assumed to be the antithesis of creative, you know?
Yeah.
And it was fascinating, but I was biting my lip a little bit. Then finally Shoshana says something about essentially, you know, well, I'm sitting here feeling, you know, people were sharing all these sort of inspired feelings, and she said something about, well, I'm sitting here feeling a lot of regret. And my ears perked up because, oh, finally someone was sort of attending to some of the gnarlier feelings too. And that was a huge relief, and I remember feeling very connected to her in that moment. Because, right, this is not, the idea here isn't to make this happy and elbow out all the hard feelings. That would be a real mistake. Quite the opposite. So hearing Shosh own the regret felt really important. And it felt really important then moving forward that she wasn't a clinician. Because medicine gets so much, the medicine assumes this subject. And as we all know, it's not just a medical subject.
Yeah.
And so it felt really good to work with Shoshana as one clinician and one non-clinician. I think that seemed really important.
Yeah, it's a great pairing. And I think also you're a palliative care and hospice physician, and you're somebody super smart and creative who has also been a family caregiver and has this real wisdom from that. In a second, I want to ask you guys if you'd be willing to read a little bit from the book. But first, I wanted to ask you, Shoshana, You talked about regret, and in the book you talk about regret. And I'm wondering, it doesn't even necessarily have to be about regret, but in your own experience, what do you wish that you had known? That's kind of my question. And the other alternate phrasing of it would be, like, how has this changed the way that you would advise someone or act in the future? Just, like, what did you learn?
So many things. I think the first thing, the most top of mind thing that we write about in the book is, I spent my whole life, I think up until that point, thinking that the world and everyone around me needed to be fixed.
Like could be improved, or like you needed to fix them?
Well, kind of both. Uh-huh. I mean, I took it on myself. I came from a house where, you know, my parents had a difficult marriage and ended up in divorce, and I always felt like, I can fix this. You know, I would, like, go and scrub the whole kitchen and, like, do crazy things thinking that it would fix their marriage. And I think my whole worldview was that, you know, when people are in trouble, they need to be fixed. And I think that's part of the folly of what happens, as what I've seen happen in healthcare, too, that... you know, sometimes people just can't be fixed. And when they can't be fixed, certainly my father's illness was incurable. People telling you that it can be fixed and you can just do this or that leads you down this path of thinking you should always be doing more. And what I found was the most profound feelings that I was actually taking care of my father were just when I showed up, you know, and just didn't run from it and wasn't constantly cycling through what more could we be doing. You know, do we need to go visit this specialty center, or, you know, does he need to be doing more exercise, or, you know, we had a doctor say to us, you know, has he tried doing yoga, and you know, eating a vegetarian diet and stuff like that. And I'm sitting there looking at him thinking, we are so far beyond
that. What are you talking
about? So I think that lesson of just showing up and not running from it and not fixing it and just bearing witness and being there was the most important lesson for me.
Would you mind reading a little section that we had talked about where I think you end up talking about this kind of same, what it felt like for you?
Sure.
Learning to do that?
Being there. At a certain point, Stanley Berger's world became a very slow and quiet place. Just turning his head to look at me took eons. We were suspended in time. His doctor said he needed peace now, no drama. I'm not a particularly quiet or slow person, so learning to be a good caregiver meant adjusting my dials and synchronizing to his pace. A meal consisted of holding a straw to his lips for a full minute so he could pull a few sips, then doing that again and again until an inch of the smoothie was drunk. Time spent together meant lying silently side by side on his bed with the TV on, or sitting on the couch watching my children play in his living room. That may sound easy, but it was agony for me. I had dirty laundry and grocery shopping and a sink full of dishes and hungry children holding up a sign of protest that read, "Don't just sit there, do something." When you become a caregiver, you learn you have to turn that phrase upside down. Don't just do something, sit there. When I could do that, pour all of my attention into the small corridor between my father and me, my heart was so full that it heated up my chest. There was no longer any point to livening our time with chatter, none of that nagging urgency to recite recent accomplishments or to try to impress him. He didn't need it. His internal word processor was too broken to really get what I was saying anyway. All he needed now was someone to hold his hand and not let him slip into oblivion alone.
Thank you. This is a slightly different topic, but could you share what else helped you during that time? And I'm particularly interested in ritual, either during the time that your dad was sick or after your dad died.
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, so obviously part of the function of religion is to surround you with ritual and community when hard things happen. And my father was Jewish, and, you know, I spent my time growing up with him in synagogue, and I'm not a particularly religious person, but going back and saying Kaddish for him, saying the mourner's prayer for him, was incredibly, incredibly profound for me because it felt like it opened up this funnel through time and space, and I was connected to him again. And I remember we were doing, you know, so in my intro you heard that I worked on modern Judaism at IDEO, which is like, it's so crazy that I go to work and get to work on these things. Because they're so personal. But I remember during that project, it was with a local startup synagogue called The Kitchen. And one morning in our project space, the client and all of these people just gathered around me in a circle and held arms and said Kaddish for me at work.
Wow.
And I completely lost it, of course. Wow. But it was such a beautiful moment to feel I could show up at work and have this circle of love and support around me. I mean, I feel absurd even talking about this because, like, it's who goes to work like that? Like, that's just it was an incredible thing. But I do think that ritual does help. And, you know, we're living in a deeply unaffiliated time when people have turned away from organized religion for good reason. There's a lot of baggage and a lot not to like, right? But I do think we need to find those things again because I think that lack of community and that lack of support when you're in free fall, in grief, is really hard for people. Mm. And it's why the church and synagogue and other places, houses of worship, can be really helpful.
You're listening to palliative care physician BJ Miller and IDEO editorial director Shoshana Berger, authors of the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death, and Dr. Lucy Kalanathy, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
BJ, would you mind telling us, so you treat very ill patients, either with serious chronic diseases or patients who are dying, and would you mind telling us what you have learned from your patients, watching them through that experience, being with them through that experience, that ended up in the book, that you learned from patients that you totally wouldn't have known, about dying or about anything, you know?
Well, I think I happen to have one patient in the audience that I know of. Tempted to speak to her. This woman, we'll call her Jay. she's the perfect example of how important humor is. Jay has dealt with many things in her life and works through tons of stuff, sometimes with others, much of the time by herself, and she is just a sort of a walking inspiration in all sorts of ways by the way she comports herself. And so every time I see Jay, it's always, basically we need to sit around and laugh is the bulk of the appointment, one way or another, all the while dealing with very serious things. Yeah. But I suppose what the lesson that Jay proves and that just bears out all the time is how... What I love about the subject, it forces you to create or craft or see a bigger worldview, because there's all these things to include. You can't just hang out in sorrow, especially with Jay. She'll make you laugh, and you got to come over here. And you know, all the time, people are holding all this huge panoply of emotions and thoughts and feelings, and the sheer necessity of ambivalence. That's not a weakness or wishy-washy thinking. In fact, in some ways, being adult, I think, is measured by how many opposing thoughts and feelings you can hold at once. Mm-hmm. And so that's a muscle I love I love to exercise with my patients that they teach me about all the time.
This makes me think of, you have a chapter in the book, I can't remember what it's called. It's called like Love and Sex and Romance or something like that. And I was so happy to see that in... this type of book. It's very unusual. So can you tell us why you decided to put that in there?
Well, you named it, because it's not in so much of the conversation. And for all sorts of reasons, I suppose. But one way or another, and another colleague of mine, a woman named Karen Skanky, who's also here tonight, and I've gotten to work with her for many, many years, and she's done all sorts of amazing work, including work in psychotherapy and sex therapy. And she would point out early on in my work where, you know, at UCSF we call the palliative care outpatient program, we call it the symptom management service. And that's a historical legacy, because the words palliative care had too much baggage, so we had to change the name to get in the door. I think those days are gone. But symptom management, if you reduce all of this work to just symptoms, you leave so much juicy stuff out. And in a strictly symptom management point of view, things, very vital things like the life of our senses, our sensual experiences, including our sexual experiences, just don't make the cut. But Karen was so good about bringing that back into the conversation, because of course it's elemental. And that's what's sort of being challenged. One of the things this subject does is it sort of brings us down to our studs, brings us down to the nub, like what is the essence of life? And it's, you know, as far as I know, I don't know what happens after we die, but I think we all agree that this body dies. And why is it interesting to have a body in the first place? Why would it be sad to see it go? Well, for many of us, that has to do with the things it can touch, it can be touched, it can feel things, you know. That's why I love having a body. So you start thinking about what a body, as people are trying to grope for a sense of meaning, as loss is just piling up, and it's so hard to keep up with the losses and try to realize what you still have, mm-hmm. which is why I think grieving as a muscle is really good to exercise in a way you can, it's a skill almost, so you can both digest what you're losing and acknowledge what you still have. And as long as you have a body, you've got something to feel. And beyond the world of the intellect, beyond the world of our thoughts, which so many of us think is the pinnacle, I think the pinnacle is really the life of the senses. I think that's the irreducible mm-hmm. piece of being human for me, at least as long as I have a body. And so anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying that this subject matter, it doesn't have to be sexual, doesn't, and it certainly doesn't have to be intercourse, but we're just talking about human connection by way of the body. And it's just an orphaned issue. Right next to death, sex is that other taboo. So, and you just sit in clinic sometimes, and oftentimes you just broach a subject. You know, are you guys, sometimes I have couples and ask, are you sexually active? Or how are you guys experiencing touch? There are other ways to get into the subject. And every time I ever have, thanks to Karen's teaching, it always pays off. People are so thrilled to be asked, and then sometimes they're just thrilled to be reminded that they still have a body and that they could hope for their body to be a source of pleasure and not just more pain.
isn't too. Karen the one who told us the great sex story in the book?
She probably did. She tells a lot of great sex stories.
Let's hear it. It's a really good one. So woman is in the hospital with her husband who's dying of congestive heart failure. And of course, what we forget is those bed rails on the hospital bed do retract. And so she was performing oral sex on her husband mm-hmm. in the hospital, and he died
yeah.
in the middle.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh,
I can't believe it. Oh,
did I just kill my husband? Did I do this? And she was so beset mm-hmm. with guilt that she didn't talk to anybody about it for like 6 months. And then she ended up in a support group because she was carrying this around, this guilt with her around for that long. And she finally was like, okay, I've got to confess something. And she blurted out the story. I was giving my husband a BJ and he died. Uh-huh. And the entire support group got up and gave her a standing ovation. It's so good. Which is awesome. And she was like, oh. So it's kind of amazing what we carry around with us. But yeah, thank you, Karen, for that story, because that was
so good.
Thank you for the great story, Karen. BJ, could you just tell us about the difference between hospice and palliative care and who should think about whether palliative care might be for them?
Mm. Yes, thank you. It's our public service announcement moment. Because by now, most of you guys, I would think, have heard of palliative care, but a lot of us even think we know what it is and don't, including doctors and nurses. I mean, it's very commonly misunderstood. So it's really important to make this distinction. So essentially, palliative care is the interdisciplinary treatment of suffering. That's our goal, is to treat suffering. This is all shorthand. There's more to it. But that's the basic gist. And that's really novel in medicine, because the rest of medicine is treating diseases. We're treating suffering. And suffering is something that everyone does. That's entirely subjective. I don't get to tell my patients if they're suffering. They tell me that. So it has this power-shifting dynamic too, which is so beautiful. But anyway, so the treatment of suffering within the context of serious illness. So you'll notice there's no mention of death in there. You can, you know, a lot of my patients, like Jay, I've been seeing for maybe 10 years. So the common misconception about palliative care is that it's end-of-life care, and it's not. And it's really important that we realize that. It is inclusive of end-of-life care, but it's just about suffering. So because commonly people wait way too long to invoke palliative care, and they suffer unnecessarily for years when there's this beautiful service just down the hall waiting for them. So keep that in mind. It's really never too soon to get palliative care. So hospice is a sort of a subset of palliative care that is sort of the treatment of suffering at the end of life. So it's a type of palliative care that is designed for the final throes of life, the final months of life. That's the distinction. One more thing is that hospice, since the 1980s, is an insurance benefit. So there's the Medicare hospice benefit. So when you say someone's on hospice, what we're saying is they're on the hospice benefit. And that, and this insurance designation that has all these sort of rules to it, like you have to have 6 months or less to live to qualify for it, and to get hospice, you have to give up curative intended care. Those are the insurance rules. Whereas palliative care is not an insurance designation per se. And palliative care, so you don't have to give up anything to get palliative care, and that's a really important distinction. In fact, palliative care works best when it's alongside aggressive intensive care.
And can you just name some diseases that people might have that
sure.
you could treat in palliative care along with their other specialists or primary care?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, just about, you name it, just about any source of suffering, in some, especially in a chronic or over time. In other words, you wouldn't call palliative care if you broke your arm and you're in pain. That's not the that kind of acute emergency kind of care. But it you know, typically chronic illness is the thing. So cancer or heart disease or lung disease, kidney disease, you name it. Neurodegenerative diseases like ALS. And some folks like my mother, a waning population who has polio, MS, you name it. Mm-hmm. Pretty much it'd be easier to name the chronic illnesses that you wouldn't seek palliative care for. In fact, I can't think of a chronic illness that you wouldn't seek palliative care for.
Cool, thank you. Mm. Could you guys speak to, maybe I'll say Shoshana, what kinds of things should everybody be doing? Like everybody in this room, and it doesn't matter your age or your health, to think about what you need to be doing to prepare in case you die or for the future. Mm. And there's some ripples out in families, right? Like, because then there's the question, like, should you be asking your loved ones to do a similar thing? And but can you speak to that?
Sure. So we're big advocates of starting this conversation really early, really far upstream. And there's a couple of life cycle moments that seem like obvious places. Like, for example, when your kid goes in to get their driver's license at the DMV and they're asked whether or not they want to be an organ donor. That's kind of an intense question. Like, it's the first moment where you contemplate, wow, I could get in a catastrophic...
It's a great example of something that's been totally normalized,
actually. Right? Yeah. And it's like you just check a box and, you know, 97% of people say they want to be organ donors and, like, a third of all people are. Because when it comes down to it, they don't sign up. And it's so that feels like an enormous opportunity. Like, what if you went into the DMV and actually had a conversation? Like, you are young and invincible now, but, you know, this is something to start thinking about. Another moment that people are unaware of is when your child becomes a legal adult and, you know, graduates from... high school, or I guess it would be somewhere in between high school and college when they turn 18, you are no longer, as their parent, able to see their healthcare records legally due to HIPAA laws, right? So if your kid gets in an accident and ends up in the hospital, it is not a given that you can see their healthcare records, that you can be involved in their care. So at that moment, when they turn 18, is when you should sit down with them and say, I think it might be a good idea for you to make me your healthcare agent.
For me to actually be your durable power of attorney and your healthcare proxy.
Exactly.
Like, interesting.
So to do an advanced care directive with your kid then, and that's another opportunity, another moment to start talking about it. I mean, throughout life, we have these moments. And the fact is that we're just a deeply phobic culture around death, and we don't talk about it until we're in an emergency.
And can you say what the When I Die folder is? Because I think when you're saying these moments, you're talking about the moments to like do a couple things and then talk about it, put in a folder, go and check on it down the line. Like, what's in the folder?
Yeah, so so the When I Die file, and this doesn't have to be a file. Like, it could be a shoebox, it could be a cloud drive, it could be whatever you want. There's like 20 things that go in this folder, and we're not going to bore you with everyone, but you know, all of your legal paperwork. So, of course, the most important thing is your advanced healthcare directive. And the reason that document is important is that it forces you to have a conversation with the person who you're going to trust with your healthcare decisions if you can't speak for yourself. So, if you end up in an accident in the hospital and you can't speak for yourself, you really want someone who you deeply, deeply trust to be able to speak for you and help direct your doctors. So that document, of course, you know, your will, your all of your passwords. I mean, we walk around just like collecting these things. They just like, they multiply on their own. And, you know, we have password managers now to help us. But if we don't give our people the password manager password, they don't have access to that, too. And I remember my sister and I trying to just find the emails of my dad's colleagues to invite them to a memorial. And we couldn't access his computer and his phone and stuff. And so this can get really, really painful.
Sure, totally.
I mean, you probably experienced
this. Yeah, the Apple ID. Apple ID. God. You can't get photos without the Apple ID.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, think of every time you've called Verizon to deal with an issue and multiply it by like a million, right? Like you're on a phone tree forever.
Right.
And here you are just trying to get out of bed.
You say something interesting. It's like, takes 16 months to close in a, like to do all the paperwork-y stuff, something like that. You say
the
number of months.
The average number, the average number of months is 16, which is
you're making it so that that paperwork is either done or can be found, or it's really smart. There's there is a list of things in your book, and it's awesome.
There's a long list, and then aside from all of the like you know stuff that you need to put in there, the passwords and all of that. We also talk about the kind of softer stuff to put in there, which I really love because people forget to do this stuff too. So like writing a letter to your people, you know, your kids, your brother or sister, your parents maybe, whoever it is. The act of sitting down and like writing a letter to people and saying what you want them to know, should you not be there, is really powerful. We do that in the book too. There's this lovely woman who may be here tonight, but I don't know, Frisch Brandt, who is kind of a letter midwife. She sits with hospice patients and has them write a letter to someone in their life. And I wrote one to my daughter, Cleo, who should be here tonight, that's in the book. And it's a really powerful exercise. And of course, I'm sure that letter will change over time as I get closer to death, but it brought me such relief just slipping that in our file and knowing that she would find it.
That's beautiful. BJ, for families who, I guess this could be any stage, like, hey, we should sit down and talk about these documents, or if somebody's really ill, like, I'd like to talk to you about X, all the things that are looming. Do you have any advice for people who are trying to figure out how to broach that conversation? Mm-hmm. Whatever that might be, how to have it, where to have it, when to have it, what to say to open it, like, what would you say to people?
It's a good question. It's very clumsy. A lot of us try to open up this conversation, end up accidentally offending folks, or, you know, you can be met with all sorts of surprising responses, again, because the subject just has it's got a lot of luggage, and it's a very emotional subject. And it was a big question from the publisher, too, is anyone going to buy this book? And we've been asked a lot, about, I want to give this book to my mom, but if I give it to my mom, what's she going to think of me? Am I sending her these crazy signals, like, I want her to die? So it's tricky. There's no easy answer there. This is kind of why I'm so excited about folks showing up to talks like this and something like Reimagine happening in the world, so that there's not so much tension around the subject, and therefore it's easier for us all to talk about. So we're getting there. But meanwhile, I think a couple tricks. Like, one is, especially talking to folks, there's some an older generation I have found that commonly, if you try to get them to talk about the end of their life for their own sake, they're not interested. But the second you say, you know, it's going to be so helpful to your kids after you're gone if you do X, Y, and Z, if you do the advanced directive, and if you talk to your kids about this, you're doing your family such a big favor. And you'll see them in a second go, oh, well, that's the case. If it's not for me, I don't know. But if it's for my family, they'll do anything for their family. So that's often a very good way in. Another good way in is if you own it yourself. So say, you know, Uncle Bill, you know, I got this book recently, or, you know, whatever. I was filling out my advanced directive recently, or whatever it is. I've been thinking about the end of my life because I got a scare, a health scare, whatever it is. Own it yourself and say, you know, I found myself thinking about the end of my life. And I have to say, it was so, I found it very enriching, actually. It wasn't so scary, and it made me realize some things about myself or certain things that I wanted. You know, and then from there, it's an easier jump to get Uncle Bill to talk about it, if you kind of own it yourself. That's a nice trick. And then I think lastly, you don't have to sort of, you know, you don't have to open the whole subject at once. In fact, I don't recommend it. It's a huge subject. There are a gazillion ways in. We need a lot of on-ramps. And sometimes the way in may be talking about what you love in life. Sitting around just talking with friends or family about all the things that are so precious to you. And there you can link from, well, gosh, someday, what's it going to be like to lose that? You know, so you can kind of ease in through love or through joy or through the things you love about life, and that can open up a bigger sort of existential conversation. So those are some tips.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guests are palliative care physician B.J. Miller and IDEO editorial director Shoshana Berger, authors of the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death, and Dr. Lucy Kalanithi, clinical assistant professor of medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The American healthcare system is, you know, like, I'm a physician, and sometimes I feel sort of like personally embarrassed, or like I want to apologize on behalf of like the system that we're all part of. And I'm just curious, I mean, embedded in this question is like, what do you wish you could change about healthcare? But I think the question I'm curious for you, and maybe I'm wondering too what you say to your patients is, like, how do you tend to orient your patients to healthcare or what healthcare can do for them, the healthcare system in particular, not just like you or office or whatever, but team, healthcare system, like what it's good for, what's not good for, and like as you go through it, like, be thinking about this or whatever. Like, is there something that you say like that?
Yeah, there's a lot to say about that. And it's so true. I mean, I feel a lot of time in clinic I spend sort of apologizing for the healthcare system, and that palliative care is really there as a sort of a corrective to mind the gaps that open up in the rest of healthcare.
Yeah.
And there's some truth to that. And sometimes apologizing for that healthcare system really often means explaining why that oncologist did this or that, or why, it, you know, it's in helping patients and families understand what folks are going through working in the healthcare system. I think it's really important to separate, in general, the critique of individuals working in the system from the system itself. Burnout is a huge problem in healthcare for good reason, because as hard as it is to be a patient in this system, it's very hard to be a practitioner too. You're so compromised, you can't do the work you are trained to do just from the daily vagaries of the system. And that's demoralizing. So it's just hard all the way around. And I think it's useful to get that across so that people aren't bashing the individual. Instead, maybe we can focus that ire towards the system's issues. So that's a little background. But bigger answer to your question, Lucy, would be, I think the sort of singular thing to get across to anyone and everyone is you cannot... Don't hand yourself over to the doctor. Even if you have a mensch for a doctor, if you have Dr. Welby as your doctor, no one has the time anymore, the way it's wired, to get at everything you're going to need and to get to know you in the old-fashioned way. I mean, there's still family medicine, and there are small-town docs, and there are relationships that are given time in medicine, but those are very rare. So you have to participate in your care in a new way. You cannot abdicate yourself. That's, I guess, my bottom line. Because otherwise, momentum takes hold, one treatment begets the other, and you just go down these paths, and you don't even know. You just sort of, momentum takes over, and you just assume that the good doctor has your best interest in mind. And they most likely do, but you need to tell them what your best interest is, because that's a highly subjective idea. And then the last point I think is critical to get across, that these are different times now, and why a book like this is necessary, and why these conversations, and why maintaining your agency is so necessary, is medicine. We have the list of things that we can do in medicine is huge and getting longer every day. So if we're waiting for us to run out of things to try, and then I'll yield to death. Don't. They're not going to run out of things to try. In fact, most of us are going to have to, there's going to become a time where we actively have to say no thanks to that next treatment if we want to get off this planet in a way that we would find meaningful. Yeah. So that's why the caution. Hope that makes sense. There's some complexities in this system of ours, but I hope that makes sense.
Great. So let's do questions. If anybody would like to start.
Marcia. This question is BJ.
Hi, Marcia.
Hi, BJ. So you mentioned regret early tonight.
Yeah.
My husband died about 10 years ago. And BJ, thank you for helping with that. Mm. He had asked if at the end of his life he could have one more MDMA experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, I said, okay. But at the end of his life, I got scared. Mm-hmm. And my regret is that I didn't make that happen. Mm-hmm. I could have made it happen. But when you mentioned early also, BJ, psychedelics and death, I want you to talk some more about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Marcia. I appreciate you sharing your story, too. And by the way, what an honor it was to be anywhere near you and John. I think one thing to kind of get across around regret is... And you can argue with me on this, but regret can be one of those proxies for love and just wanting one more thing together, you know? And if you had had that experience with MDMA, I bet you would have found one other thing to say, gosh, I wish I could have done that. I wish I could have done that. And in a way, I hear that as saying that your love and your desire to be with him is just sort of inexhaustible. And so on some level, and I don't mean to put the words in your mouth, but when I try to metabolize regret, I think of regret as sort of a fear of the past, in a way. And coming to realize, trying to reconcile the finite nature of our lives with the sort of infinite desires we may have or the infinite love we may have, that's a clunky mismatch. And so for any of us who love life, we're bound to die with some regrets of things that we just didn't get to. That maybe or may not be helpful. But you bring up the idea of psychedelics at the end of life, and this is one of the things that's most exciting to me right now that's happening, you know, besides us finally talking about these things in an open and honest way. You know, in medicine, I think sort of existential fear, existential distress, essentially sort of a crisis of meaning, which, you know, if you think about us human beings, we're meaning, that's a nutrient for us. And my guess is existential distress. It's now getting acknowledged as a phrase in healthcare, but a lot of us wouldn't think that that's our jurisdiction. But I think if you step back, I think most of us are dealing with illness are trying to make meaning from that illness. I think probably existential distress is the number one cause of any doctor visit, I would imagine, one way or another. And to date, we have, when someone comes to us with a crisis of meaning and there's anxiety around it, we don't have much to offer. Maybe we'll sort of indirectly treat it with a Valium and maybe sort of sedate their anxieties. But that's a poor substitute for actual meaning making. So at this moment, finally there's a resurgence of old research around LSD, psilocybin, MDMA. Where these drugs were taken seriously at one point, then all sorts of things happened. The government got involved, and popular culture ran away with it in this, that, and this, that way. And all of a sudden, those things became sort of verboten. Now there's a resurgence, you guys might well know. I mean, CIIS has a certificate training program in psychedelic-assisted therapy here in San Francisco. I mean, there's some real momentum happening. Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. Your own work, Marcia. But essentially, the data were, you know, Johns Hopkins, NYU, UCSF, there are trials studying psilocybin specifically, and other drugs too, for this more like angst, this existential distress, is studied in people who are facing mortality themselves and are just paralyzed by it. And the data are stunning. So in the psilocybin data, I think there's about 400 test subjects to date, zero adverse events. And most everyone walks out, and these are not thrill seekers. These are folks who are trying to make meaning of their lives. Most everyone walks out of this one-time experience. It's guided. It's very important structure to it. It's guided, and there's an integration moment after the trip. And people walk out of these experiences feeling connected to the cosmos and the world around them, entirely losing their fear of death. These are stunning results. These are direct, meaning-making results. And what's more is they seem to last for months beyond that one trip. So this is just, we have nothing like this in medicine. And now maybe we do. So there's more study to be done. Maybe there are adverse events out there that we ought to look out for, et cetera. Some amount of caution here. But nothing but optimism. And I'm just thrilled. I feel like this is a real heyday in the making.
Hi. I'm a design master's student. And I'm really curious about the outcome of the project that you guys worked on together. Mm-hmm. Were you able to rebrand hospice? And overall, what do you feel like the role of design is in the space?
Mm. Well, thank you for that question. I'm so encouraged by the fact that a master's in design is here at this talk. That's awesome. So, yeah, you know, what I learned landing at IDEO is that everything is designed. Like, every experience in life is designed, right? And so, you know, I talk about it like rebranding hospice, but in effect, what we were trying to set out to do, I think, was to give people the sense that they could have some agency in designing the end of their own lives, that you do have some say in that. Can you control everything? No, of course not. There are times when you'll be yielded little control, but setting out with the intention of being an engaged and active participant in that experience is a kind of design. And just speaking to the outcome of that project, I mean, that project was pretty limited around Zen Hospice and trying to get the word out about a specific hospice and hospice in general, but I'll say the outcome of that project was this. I mean, you know, BJ wrote a TED Talk right after that project. I helped him a little bit with that. That TED Talk has been seen by almost 10 million people, which is just bananas. And we set out to write the book on the back of that. And, you know, what we're really trying to do in this exercise is give people a sense that they can lean into this and be the designers of their own lives. And, you know, again, you say this all the time, Lucy, like so much of writing about death, talking about death, is just learning how to live, right?
Yeah.
Just learning how to live with intention and design. So, you know, when you go through that experience of taking care of someone as they're dying, you just realize how little time we really have. You know, we've got like 5 minutes here. And so let's live that 5 minutes. Let's really live it and suck the marrow out, right? So thank you. So this was really the outcome of that project.
Reimagine too,
and reimagine. I mean, reimagine came out of IDEO as well. It was born at IDEO out of this. You know, we helped design the original experience of a civic conversation around death, which has scaled into this incredible community event, which BJ and I are both on the board. We're super proud of what Brad and Jeannie have done, and it's traveling to other cities now. Basically, like everyone into the pool, the more that we can be talking about this and have people like design students in these conversations and young ICU nurses, wow, that's just, we feel really emboldened by that. It's really great.
Hi, Shoshana. It's Jennifer Holmes. We went to high school together. Hi, BJ. We were at Zen Hospice. We were at Zen Hospice together.
What?
So,
I
was at Zen Hospice when BJ came on, and I'd been there a couple of years. And even though you weren't a Buddhist practitioner, you totally jumped right in and flowed with us perfectly. And I just wanted to know what you got from us as Buddhist practitioners, as a palliative care doctor coming into our weird, super earnest space.
Yeah, it was a wild experience entering that place. It really took me a while to get my bearings. It's a remarkable place. But to answer your question, Jennifer, two things leap out. I mean, in a way, they're the reasons I went there, and those reasons got fleshed out in a beautiful way for me. One was just this sort of proof that living until you die, that death is not just a medical event, you know, that having a place that is led largely by volunteers, where spirituality forms the basis of the work versus medical science, you know, you don't have to, fortunately, it's not one or the other, and that's, I think, the point we were trying to make by marrying some of these things together. But you guys made the point so beautifully that the spiritual approach to care and a volunteer, sort of a non-professional approach to care, could do such amazing work. This is not esoteric. It's probably the least esoteric subject there is, in a way. That was beautiful to behold and to witness and learn from. And then the second piece was something that, you know, that the that speaking of design, that the bricks and mortar of the guest house in particular. I mean, there's a certain portability to the work that's done in Laguna Honda versus the guest house or anywhere else. That a lot of that beauty flows with the person wherever they're going. But there was something about the house, too, of having that Victorian space and seeing what the environment of care, never mind the people in it, in addition to the people in it, that's the house itself had this palliative effect. You felt it the second people walked through that door. That was beautiful to behold, and it convinced me that one of the ways this movement can accelerate is getting architects and interior designers involved. That once you start seeing illness and death as an experience, well, then, you know, that opens the door of how an experience gets crafted, and it's largely by environmental and material cues. So it's a huge palette to work with that we've barely scratched the surface. So those are the two pieces that I'll carry with me as long as I can remember. Thank you.
So please help me thank them for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were palliative care physician BJ Miller and IDEO editorial director and former editor-in-chief and co-founder of Ready Made magazine, Shoshana Berger. Their new book is A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. Joining them was Dr. Lucy Kalanithi, clinical assistant professor of medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine, and the widow of the late Dr. Paul Kalanithi, author of the New York Times best-selling memoir When Breath Becomes Air, to which she wrote the epilogue. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aidan Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.